The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
Well, he's trying to make it work. Tell a couple of stories. One is that if Buddhism depended on having air conditioners, especially in its, you know, for hundreds of years it was only in India, it wouldn't have survived. And also in that, when I was in Japan, sometimes practicing in the monasteries there, it was very hot and humid, much hotter than this. And then it was also really cold in the winter, really cold. And the monasteries, you know, basically had no... You got it? Thank you. And the monasteries had no, you know, some of them had no insulation. And sometimes in the cold Siberian winds would come down, we would have to sit and meditate at night outside on the engawa, on the deck, on the porch, with shaved heads. So hot and cold was, you know, kind of part of the deal. And so the Zen masters in Japan would like to ask questions like, what do you do when it's hot? Or do you prefer hot or cold? When Zen masters ask you questions, it's really a test. And some of these questions they'd ask, I give an answer, and they kind of go, they grunt. And then they would say, 70%. It's like a grade, or like it was only 70% good as an answer. But one of them, you know, they said that when you're cold, just be cold. When you're hot, just be hot. So I guess it's working now, Jim. Is it coming? Feel any cold air coming in? Those of you close by. Okay, so. If it's too hot for those out there, it might be getting cooler in here. You're welcome to come in. There's only a couple of seats, but there's floor space. Or maybe the cold air will go out. So, once upon a time, there was a man who grew up in a life of privilege, pretty comfortable, and pretty much as he grew up, whatever he needed was provided for him, got a good education, and when he became an adult, a young man, he was granted or given, because he was wealthy, all the pleasures that we associate with the sensual realms. He had easy access to music, food, luxurious goods, women, and it was a pretty, you know, luxurious life, maybe even an indulgent life. And then at some point, he, as he got older, well into adulthood, he started noticing the things he hadn't noticed when he was younger. And he noticed that people were getting old. Maybe his parents were getting old, other people were getting old, and he was a little bit surprised by this old thing. And then he noticed that there were people who were getting sick. Maybe he got sick. And it kind of was sobering. Maybe sometimes you see people who get really sick. It can be, you know, if you've never had much of that, it's kind of sobering. And then he started to notice that people were dying. And I think many of you, you know, at some point, some people experience death in their family and their community right from an early age. But it's not uncommon for some people not to encounter death until well into their adulthood. No one in their family dies, and, you know, I knew a woman recently who, I think she was maybe 47 before she saw a dead body. And that was only because she was working in a hospital. And so he started to encounter death, and it was also pretty sobering. Today I was told that one of my teachers in Burma, a man named Ulakana, he died at the age of about 80. Today I learned that 4 months ago he was diagnosed with pancreatic cancer. So that goes quickly, right? So we encounter death, and that's, you know, quite something. Especially for someone who's kind of been isolated, privileged life, protected from it. And so then his all this luxury he was living in not only paled in importance, but he got kind of disturbed by it. And he walked away from it all. And he kind of reacted to it, and he just walked away with everything, left it all behind, and started walking around the countryside, walking around the cities and walking around, and lived a pretty poor life. Homeless, no money, and wandered around for a long time, shunning anything to do with sensuality and luxury and privilege that he had. And he got thinner and thinner and weaker and weaker. And at some point he started stumbling and falling in his weakness. And people started treating him pretty poorly, avoiding him, kicking him, doing things to him because he was just this decrepit, thin, weak, dirty, emaciated kind of person, homeless guy. And at some point he decided that, you know, he was close to death. And he said, you know, I don't think it makes sense to kind of just keep doing this just to die. And but he didn't want to go back to the life he had before, the life he knew before. So he went someplace where he could rest. He hadn't rested before. He'd always been wandering, and he ate some food, started eating food, and started getting some of his strength back. And as he got his strength back, and just kind of resting and hanging out and just being sat under a tree, and he remembered his childhood. You know, he had a good childhood. But what he remembered was, as a very young child, he remembered experiences of feeling very safe and contented and happy. That didn't seem to have anything to do with the luxury and the sensuality and the things that he had at the time. It seemed like it didn't require that at all. It was more of an inner sense of well-being. And he remembered maybe he had long forgotten it, but remember this wonderful feeling of peace and well-being, inner feeling. Maybe he remembered the actual visceral feeling of what it was like. And it felt like a good thing to him. It felt like a good, healthy thing. And so he turned towards that experience, and he allowed that experience to come back to him, and he allowed it to come up again, this inner embodied feeling of safety, of peace, contentment, happiness, joy. And he allowed it to get stronger. And as he allowed it to get stronger, he noticed that if he picked up his thoughts, if he picked up his desires, his aversions, that he would disturb that peace. But if he let go of all of it, he would actually get quieter and quieter. The mind would get quieter and quieter, more and more peaceful. It felt even better than what he had as a kid. And then he started to review his life. Not an uncommon thing to do. They say that when you're, I don't know, in a split second before you think you're going to die, if you're like in an accident, people review their lives. So he reviewed his life. And one of the things that came up as he reviewed his life was that not necessarily the details of his life, but the common denominator of all the experiences, the thread that went through them all. Interesting question to ask. What's the common denominator? What's a common thread that runs through all the different experiences you've had in your life, as varied as they might be? And then he started kind of spontaneously also reflecting about all the people he'd ever known, all the people around, and saw that just like he had gone through luxury and then poverty and you know, up and down, ups and downs, and of human life. And he also reflected on the commonality, the common thread that ran through their lives. You know, was there not just his life, but also the common thread that ran through all human beings' lives and the ups and downs they go through. And then, thinking about those common threads, common denominators, he saw it as being craving, clinging, holding, attachment. That in all the different things that he was doing, all the different things people are doing, one of the common things was the degree to which human beings are attached. That they hold on, they're clinging, they're grasping, craving, wanting to push things away, wanting to have things. And there's an infinite variety of things that people want, but just the wanting is always there. And then he turned his mind to the possibility of putting down the wanting, putting down the craving, letting it go, and letting it kind of fade away, letting it fall away, let it disappear. And he saw it come, he saw it go, he saw the craving arrive and come, back and forth, it arose and passed, arose and passed. And then at some point he saw the arising of it, and then it passed, but somehow in the passing he was so relaxed about it, so at peace with it, that craving just kind of didn't just fade away, but it suddenly, in a way that he never had experienced before, dropped away. It ceased. And his mind got really clear, really feeling of peace, in a way. And then he felt like it was time to start walking again. And he started walking around, and he went to find his old friends. He had other homeless, poor people who were wandering around, and he went and found them, but they were buddies, so they weren't so interested in him, what he had to say. He said, "Oh, you guys, I have something to tell you." It took a while to get their attention, but somehow he was able to teach them too. Look, there's this possibility, this common thread that runs through human life that is doesn't have to be there. The craving, the clinging, the attachment, doesn't have to be there. It's possible to have it fall away. And he taught him a little bit how to do that, what he'd learned by himself. And then he spent decades kind of just continued to be homeless, but no longer being emaciated, no longer starving himself, no longer trying to live a life of denial, but also not interested in the life of sensual pleasure or luxury. And he encountered many people and talked to them. There's a beautiful book of a woman in America who did this called The Peace Pilgrim. Anybody read The Peace Pilgrim? It used to be given out for free. And I think started in the 1950s, 54, during the Korean War, she started walking for peace. And she walked for decades across the country. And she had almost nothing. She had what if it would fit in her kind of pockets of her jacket, I think. And she walked for decades, and people would invite her into her home to sleep with them, and she would feed her, or she'd sleep out in the fields, whatever. She was just went. And she would talk to people about peace, transform lives. So this man also walked around and talked to people and transformed lives. And then he got to be an old man. And as an old man, he continued to walk. And he had friends who were in trouble, and he walked to find them and try to help them. Some of the last things he did. And then at some point, he got really sick, a lot of pain, but he kept walking. And then at some point he couldn't go anymore. And then he laid himself down under a tree. People came and be with him, attend him or be with him in his last hours. And then in that experience of peace and well-being that he had as a kid that he remembered, he kind of went back to that place again and went into that area, those places of deeper peace and well-being that he experienced, feeling of wholeness, of completeness, of peace, of well-being, of safety, contentment. Right there where he was dying. What a remarkable thing to do as you're dying. And in one of those, in those states of deep abiding peace and well-being, this, his ability to let go, he let go, and he passed away. Peacefully, happily, passed away. So that's a story, and that's the story of the Buddha's life. It's told without some of the aspects of ancient India, some of the details, kind of to make it every person's story, kind of. And it's an important story for Buddhists. You know, there are people, scholars of religion, some scholars of religion, who have said that the core aspect of religion is not the tenets or the beliefs of the, you know, tenets or the, you know, the truths of the religion, but rather it's the stories the religions tell, and that people organize themselves and relate to the stories of religion much more to than the beliefs. I don't know if it's true, but it's interesting how central stories are and how religious people kind of compare themselves to stories or are inspired by stories, model themselves in stories, see themselves in the stories. So for Buddhists, they see themselves or see their lives through the story that, of the Buddha's life. We don't know how much of that story is a myth, how much of it is true, but as some of us think, you know, myths also have a certain kind of truth, and maybe they're more true than if we actually had a, you know, the live, you know, video documentary of the Buddha's life. But maybe the myth somehow speaks to these inner truths. And so, you know, we know here in the West we have the story of Christ who died one way. And that's a story that has a huge impact on Western culture. And it's very symbolic. You know, as you know, many people in the West take Christ's crucifixions in all kinds of wonderful symbolic ways. There's a lot of depth and heart and maturity and wisdom in the way that that's taken symbolically and applied to human life. And the same thing with the Buddha's death. That's also Buddha's life and death. It has, you know, a tremendous value in terms of symbolizing certain possibilities of human life, certain way of understanding human life. And it tends to be an understanding that promotes wholeness, completeness, peace, compassion and love, and a certain kind of I think certain kind of being at home in this world, that you don't have to leave the world, but you live in the world, and you live in the world, and then when you die, dying is not a mistake, dying is not a tragedy, dying is not a, you know, dying this way that the Buddha died. It's completely part of the natural world, and to be at peace with that for oneself, to be able to kind of face one's death, be at ease. Not in ease, but have a sense of profound well-being. And in that state of well-being, to die, that is quite an accomplishment for any human being. And many people are quite afraid of death, disturbed by it. I know people who... I have people in my family, extended family, who, even though they're 80 years old, really refuse to talk about anything to do with death. You know, it's like, don't bring up bad news. You know, it's, don't be depressing. It's just like not capable of dealing with it all except by avoiding it. And so the Buddha discovered something. He rejected the sensual, luxurious life, the overindulgent life. And then at some point he rejected asceticism, self-denial. So overindulgent in oneself, and underindulging in a sense. And what he taught was the middle way. And from us in the modern world, and this kind of, the kind of lifestyle we live here, the lifestyle the Buddha lived could seem pretty ascetic, pretty self-denying. But in the context of ancient India, it was not that way. In fact, he was criticized for being too soft because he didn't starve himself. He didn't... walk around naked. He didn't do austerities. that living in constant pain. He lived a lifestyle. Certainly he was homeless. He had almost no possessions. But the lifestyle that he chose, in which he designed for his monastic followers, was a lifestyle where there was just enough to be comfortable and safe. Just enough clothes to stay warm in the cold part and to be able to keep the bugs off in the hot part of the year. Enough food to nourish the body and make it strong and capable, but not too much food, not too little food. Just enough medicine to be able to take care of oneself in the medicine of the times. And just enough shelter to protect oneself also from the elements. But not more than was needed. And this idea of just enough for him was the middle way. So, you know, in our society, what's just enough? I mean, I don't think we're going to go homeless. But he had just enough. And the idea was just enough so that there can be comfort and well-being and strength so that the deeper work of meditation, of self-inquiry, of freedom, of teaching, of compassionate work could be done, could be engaged in. So just enough. So what is just enough for you? What would be just enough for you to do that same path, to do that same deep work? What are the pursuits that you are engaged in? Do you pursue sensual pleasure? Do you pursue luxury? And I know a lot of people who say, oh, wait, I don't really pursue sensual pleasure. I'm not a hedonist. But then if you took a look at their lives, and you live in a home that's bigger than you need, but you want to live in a home that's pleasant. Do you have a car that's bigger and nicer and newer than you need? Well, yeah, because it's pleasant. the food you buy, is it just enough food? Well, yeah, it's more than that. Actually, chocolate, I eat chocolate. it's pretty soon you realize that, I think in our environment around here, I think there's a fair number of people who consume and buy and do things that aren't really needed, but it's for their pleasure, it's for their enjoyment, it's nourishing, it somehow creates a nice ambience. And maybe that's fine. But, to pursue, or then there's self-denial. There are people who do that, that deny themselves, in a way that results in pain and discomfort. And so they would have the middle way. And then he discovered this inner path, this inner way of really tracking one's mind, really monitoring one's mind really well, to be able to both quiet the mind, but more important, with a quiet mind and a clear mind, to really see the common thread that runs through, the underlying common denominator of how of the operating principle that's behind human life. And much of human life is driven by certain emotions, driven by certain desires, and not just any desire, but often desire which comes along with compulsion and need and clinging and grasping and insisting neediness. And you can review your life and see if the ups and downs, successes and failures. If you get kind of only focused on the details of what happened to you, you get one story. But if you can find the common denominator that runs through it all, you tell yourself a different story. You see a different part. And as you know, if you find the common denominator of a mathematical problem, it becomes a lot easier to do the problem, right? Things just fall away. So if you can find the common denominator of your life, then it's applicable. And what you discover then is applicable in all aspects of your life. And so this is what the Buddha did, is he discovered something that was applicable to all aspects of ordinary human life. And so you don't have to go around solving every possible life situation you came into, because it's complicated life. But you have to, once you were sensitive to it, you can tune in to clinging, to grasping, to aversion, to tightening, contraction. rather than the details of the story, the event that's happening in the moment. And learn how to find inner peace, inner ease, by tending to that common denominator. And the Buddha did that, and he discovered something that wasn't just a degree of peace and ease, more and more peace and calm. The Buddha wasn't like the first person to do stress reduction, but rather he did that. He followed this path, and he discovered something remarkable, where something actually dropped, something actually turned around or shifted or was transformed in that clinging and the grasping, where something of it just was able to really drop away once and for all. And then you don't have to go, then you don't have to keep going back and studying the common denominator. You don't have to keep going back and figuring it out, you know, even the common denominator, because there's no common denominator anymore. And because there's no common denominator anymore, the Buddha no longer, when he encountered people, he didn't want to take on any ordinary human identity. Because identity is one of the things we hold on to. And so when people kind of said, you know, who are you? Or if he talked about himself, he didn't say he was a teacher, he didn't say he was a Brahmin, he didn't say he was the warrior caste, or came from a Sakya country, or he didn't say that he was, all kinds of things that he might have said. The most common way the Buddha referred to himself was to say it in a little bit colloquial terms in English, I'm thus. I'm like this. The one who is thus. I'm like this. Doesn't tell you much, does it? Who are you? I'm like this. I'm, you know, it's a little bit irritating, I know, if people were did run around that. But I think it's also something very profound, very meaningful, to not take anything on, just to be here, kind of empty or clear. Or, you don't need to be anything. Be at peace, you don't have to be anything, just here. I'm just this. I don't know who I am, I'm just this. Thus, I am what you see, or something. And then he spent 46 years teaching. Quite a long teaching career, wandering around India, talking to all kinds of people. And as he in his wanderings, people came up to him and would come and visit him and ask him questions. And sometimes he would give talks, to mostly to his monks, but to others. And taught and taught and taught. Created a monastic community. And then I got to be an old man. And it seems from the stories of his time, the records that kind of survive, if you kind of look at the cracks, the little things that are being said on the side, because the people who compiled the ancient records didn't care about the history so much, they were more about the teachings and the real teachings and practices the Buddha was about. But in the edges of those teaching stories, it seems that the end of the Buddha's life was a time of social collapse, so chaos, war. For a man who spent 46 years walking around talking to people peacefully, and he had friends who were kings, friends everywhere. The kings he knew were being usurped from power or being killed. The countries he traveled through and lived in were going to war with each other. His main disciples died before him. It seemed like it was a time of great social, you know, society was kind of crumbling and falling around him. And it's kind of poignant, this idea that the society of the Buddha's times was going to war and death and problems. His life hadn't prevented that. His teachings hadn't prevented society, hadn't created social harmony. Society was crucifying itself at his time. Christianity, it's the teacher who got crucified. In the Buddha's time, it was the society around him that was crucifying itself. Societies do that. Some of our societies nowadays do that. But he stayed at peace. He stayed engaged. He was peaceful. The friend he was trying to help at the very end, he walked, I don't know how many miles, a few hundred miles, to try to help his friend, was the king who had been usurped and had been sent into exile. And he tried to follow him in exile. Looks like maybe to help him. Before he could help him, the king died, the old man. And then he turned around to walk 200 miles or so back, where he came from, 81-year-old man. But he didn't. He looked like he was going to go home to his home country, but he didn't make it. As the story is recounted, he laid himself down between two trees, and the literary description of the situation was very beautiful and peaceful. And in that beautiful, peaceful place, the images between laying down between two trees, standing upright, flowering. There are flowering trees, dropping their flowers all around, as opposed to two trees they were crossed over to get crucified on. It's quite a different kind of image and story. There was a great Indian, Cambodian teacher, kind of the patriarch, only a few surviving monks after the Pol Pot massacres in Cambodia, was a wonderful man named Mahagosananda, kind of the Gandhi of Cambodia. I met him in San Francisco some 20 years ago. I was having a meal with him, and and one of the things he was doing then, he was planting trees in Cambodia. Cambodia had been devastated. So he was reforesting the place. This is one of his projects. I said, to provoke him, I guess, a little bit to find out what he would say. I said, you're a Buddhist monk. What are you doing planting trees? You're a great teacher. You should be teaching people and meditating and, training people in the monastery or something. He looked at me so kindly and patiently. And he said, the Buddha was born under a tree. He was enlightened under a tree. He taught under trees and he died under trees. Trees are important. So I plant trees. So the Buddha died under a tree. So I think it could be a story from someone today. I think it could be someone's life story. And maybe with different details. Maybe it could be one of your stories. Maybe it could be your story. Maybe you could do this. Maybe you could discover what the common denominator, the common thread that runs through your life, what it is. And maybe you can pull that thread out. Maybe you don't need some of that common denominator. If the common denominator is what brings you suffering, distress, fear, anxiety. And maybe you can discover how to pull the thread out in such a way that your life is a teaching, your life is a blessing, your life is a peacemaking event for this world that needs so much peace and blessing. And maybe for your sake and for the sake of those you know, you too can die peacefully. It's a really great gift to give to the world and to others. I think it's one of the great incomparable gifts that you can pass on, your legacy to the people who know you, is to die with no anxiety whatsoever, to die peacefully, happily. Isn't that great? Because that inspires people. It shows people a possibility. It shows people some of the greatest possibilities of how to live in this life, how to be in this life, and how to participate in that part of life which is also is our dying. So the Buddha, his story. So what you got today was one person's, my kind of retelling, my take. Because that's what religious people do. They tell the stories over and over again. And every telling is told differently. So now it's your turn to tell the story. And to tell it to yourself. So we have a few minutes. Do you have any comments or questions that you'd like to ask about what I said?
I understand that the Buddha passed away because he ate a plate of spoiled food. This is what I learned in a documentary about him. Is that true?
The story goes that he was walking back toward, probably north. He was walking north, but probably back to his home country. And he was quite old, 81 years old. He said at that time that his body was like an old chariot held together with straps kind of falling apart. He said he was in a lot of pain. Remember, this is before they had even aspirin, let alone pain medication and medicine like we know it. So to be 81 years old in ancient India, maybe, you know, and with no modern medicine. So he was in a lot of pain, physical pain, maybe had arthritis, he had back pain, we know. And I'm getting to it. And so old guy. And then he came and he was given a meal. And we don't know. The problem with knowing what he ate is that we don't know what the Pali word. But the literal meaning of the word is he ate pig's delight. So was it pork that was bad, or was it mushrooms that pigs love to eat? We don't know. Some people say it's mushroom that he ate. But he ate something that the Buddha said, "This other people shouldn't eat this. This is not good for anyone to eat. And when I finish eating whatever I eat, bury everything else." But he ate it, and he got violently sick, in a lot of pain. But he recovered from it enough that he continued his walk. He had diarrhea and everything. And he continued his walk going north. So I don't know to what degree that he ate whatever he ate was the cause of his death or not. I don't know. But it certainly contributed to his weakness as he kind of in his old age probably. But he kept walking for a while longer until at some point he laid himself down for the last time.
Well, the story I heard was that he accepted the food not to offend his guest, even though he knew it was spoiled, didn't want to offend the person who was giving it to him, so he ate it, and that's what happened, so he died.
Right. So it's possible that's what he did. It's an interpretation. That literally, all we have the record of, remember this is 2,500 years ago, right? There's just a few lines in a certain text. And he said that Chunda, the blacksmith, offered pig's delight to the Buddha. The Buddha looked at it and he told the other people, "Don't eat this. I know only one person who can eat this, and that's the Tathagata, the one who is thus." And so he ate some and he gave it. Then he stopped eating and he gave instruction for it to be buried. So that's about all it says. So it's possible that a fair interpretation would be that he felt like it was an offering from this man and he wanted to honor the offering. But we don't know if that's the case. We don't know, you know, it's kind of cryptic what that whole story is about. You know, all the statues of the Buddha are, you know, he's still pretty young. And as far as I know, there are no statues of the Buddha as an old man. There's a few statues of him being in his ascetic times, all emaciated and all that. But there are in the ancient records, ancient texts, he sometimes depicts himself as being all bent over and all wrinkled, and you know. So, you know, we tend to idealize, or we tend to use these stories and use religious founders. Not for who they are historically, but rather as symbolisms, as symbolic purposes, or as representations of something. And so, I see it that way, that there's something about the idealized version of these stories, or idealized versions of the depictions, the icons, and all that, which is not talking about a historical being, but rather are but meant to be a mirror, a reflection of you. that when you sit down to meditate and your meditation is deep and strong, you kind of feel that way inside. And some of the beautiful tankas, Tibetan Buddhist paintings, with full of colors and auras and all this kind of stuff, are highly symbolic or highly representational of what happens, what people feel like from the inside out when they're doing meditation. And so when you look at that, you're kind of seeing yourself. So that's why this idealization of the Buddha is, it's not so much that the Buddha is being held up, but rather has this representational or symbolic meaning that we see ourselves in that. So the same thing in the story I told you, the story of the Buddha's life. it has certain usefulness, not because the story is true or false. It has a usefulness that in a true way we see ourselves in the story. We can, or it helps us see our own lives in an important way. And the story of the Buddha in some ways is the idea of encountering sickness, age, old, and death, and that being a turning point. That's a story of many people. They encounter these things and it makes a big difference and they change their lives or they pursue something or they don't and they get more, you know, that has its consequences. And then to really face these things and look at them and really face oneself down to the depth, the roots of who we are. And then to be able to face one's own death, to face one's relationship to the world around. You know, how do you relate to the world around you? The Buddha related to the world by teaching. And then how do you relate to your own death? So these stories kind of point to all these different junctures in human life. And maybe it helps us to reflect and to question and wonder. And what's nice about the story of the Buddha, it's a story of of peace, enlightenment, liberation, and freedom that I hope can be your story. Good luck. Thank you.